4. Now a crew of men and women, most of the same species as the tall man, but some furrier or rounder, labored at the black wall. One of them used a flame device, like Ryuk's, to heat the wall. Then he nodded and stepped back, and a woman stepped up and used her own device. Whiteness sprayed from the hose she held, the hose attached to the tank on her back, and the air got cold, very cold. The whiteness struck the heated stone. The stone shrieked. The tall man liked the sound of that, but only a small bit of the stone fell free. The tall man picked it up. It stung his fingers with lingering heat. It was heavy, far heavier than stone should be. The man and the woman looked over the tiny crack formed in the wall's surface. They made noises at one another. Then the woman, apprehension on her face, turned to the tall man, forming images. The tall man reached out and plucked them forth. The hot and cold would succeed, she told him, in a long time. What is a long time, he asked. A light and a dark? Many lights and darks, she said. Many ground shakes would come and go. The plants would make many more buildings fall. Small things would grow and old things would die. The tall man growled, and the woman staggered back from the force of his anger. But she had another thought, and she forced her way forward to give it to him. It was a machine with arms and knobs and treads, and she imagined it standing before the wall, using its own cutting flames and pounding knobs to shatter the stone. With contempt, he dismissed the idea. He imagined himself standing side by side with the machine, striking the wall himself, neither of them doing any harm to its surface. She shook her head, a sign he'd come to understand, and changed his image. In it, he became smaller and smaller, until he was nothing but a tiny dot, standing beside one of the machine's treads. He scowled at her, not understanding. She showed herself beside him, also tiny, and drew him into her eyes. He saw through them as she looked up and up and up at the machine. He understood then. He hadn't shrunk. He'd misunderstood. The machine was vast, the width of a gap between buildings, as tall as this enormous chamber. The tall man laughed. The woman and all the other workers, suffused with his humor, also laughed. Weaker than he, they laughed until they coughed, laughed until they fell over, while he watched them in good cheer. Only when some of them began coughing out blood did he relent. He stood over the woman with all the thoughts and made one of her own. In it she found one of those machines and brought it here. She nodded, but too weak to obey immediately. It was minutes before she could rise and go about her new errand. Borlios. Jag was waiting for Jaina when she emerged from her briefing with General Antilles. "A moment of your time, Great One?" he asked. She cocked her head as if considering the demands on her time, then nodded. "A moment." He led her from the office and gestured down the hall to a little-used conference room. When they were within, and the door shut behind them, she wrapped her arms around his neck, felt his strength as he pulled her to him. She overbalanced him, shoving him toward the wall beside the door, and kissed him. The boom of Jag's shoulders hitting the wall startled her out of the kiss, and she laughed. "There goes discretion," Jag said. He smiled, the expression characteristically subtle enough to be missed by most observers. "Got carried away?" she said. "I'd like to be carried away." "I have the time if you do." She shook her head, regretful. "I have to find a pilot to bring in the twin sons. Your uncle is giving me a B-wing, the same one Lando used to escape from the record time mission, and I need a pilot for it." She gave him a wicked smile. "I get to go to anyone I want and see if I can persuade him to leave his squadron. Another reason for all the other squadron commanders to hate me." "They don't need any more reasons. You're a better pilot than any of them," And you're even prettier than Colonel Darklighter of the Rogues. She thumped his chest. All right, you're prettier than Captain Reth with the Black Moons. She thumped him harder. Prettier than Wes Jansen with the Yellow Aces? I'm going to break a bone you'll need later. He finally grinned, pleased with her reaction to his teasing. Do you have any pilots in mind? I was thinking of asking Zek. Jack frowned. He's not that good. Well, he's adequate, and I don't plan for the B-Wing to be a major contributor to our skirmishes. I'm going to have it fitted as a control station for some of my goddess stunts. It'll be a little mobile headquarters. All the more reason to have a top-notch pilot in it. If it's not going to be an assault craft, it needs to be able to dodge and outfly pursuers. Do you have a pilot in mind? He considered, then nodded. Shuttle pilot named Belyath. He flies rescue missions, picking up EV pilots. I've seen him do some pretty good tricks with his shuttle and fly into enemy fire to pick up pilots. He was one of the ones who helped us retrieve those ejected victims when the Yuuzhan Vong worldship came into the system. And he's Mon Cal. I know he has starfighter experience, which makes me suspect he has B-Wing experience. I'll talk to him. She could feel her spirits sag just a little, could feel the smile leave her face. I have to go. We just can't seem to find much time, can we? Do you have another 60 seconds? Yes. He leaned down for another kiss. Yuuzhan Vong, worldship, Coruscant orbit. Speak, Savang Law said. Nin Yim straightened from her bow. I have subjected the samples I took from your arm to analysis. Is my situation favorable? It is, War Master. The cure to your situation is no more complicated than refusing any further treatments at the hands of Githradal. Material I found upon your arm, material that must have come from Githradal touching you, inspires the rod ankh leg to continue growing. It is absorbed into your skin and carried into the depths of your arm by the carrion eaters. Remove the material, and the condition should end. Yet if I were to discontinue treatment at the hands of Githradal, he would know that I suspect him. Wisely, Nin Yim chose not to reply. Whether she had an opinion on the matter or not, she knew it was not her place to advise the War Master on matters of strategy. Any recommendation she could make would not be well received. Can you shape a material that would negate the effects of Githradal's doings while allowing him to continue to treat me? Perhaps, War Master. But the material that coaxes your rod ankh leg to grow as it does is very subtle, very complex. It could be that Githradal has been developing it for a very long time. Just having the samples I obtained, being able to observe their effects on other rod ankh flesh, is not the same as knowing exactly how it works its effects, which is the first step toward counteracting it. It could take some considerable time to shape a defensive material, time or access to Githradal's shaping chambers. Savang Law considered, then nodded. I will find a way to give you one, if not both. Withdraw. When she was gone, he allowed himself to revel in an all-too-rare moment of simple elation. Doom was not upon him. The gods did not punish him. He faced nothing more serious than treachery. And treachery was something he well knew how to deal with. Less familiar to him was the notion of reward, especially as it applied to one who was not Yuuzhan Vong, one who was not a loyal warrior or advisor. "Send in Vicky Shesh," he said. Vicky entered the chamber, somewhat thrown off her rhythm by the fact that her escort guards, instead of staying beside her as she passed through the portal, remained behind. She hesitated just within the chamber, her quick glance ticking in the presence of Savang Law, on his seat of command, of his advisers and servants staying well away along the walls. "Come to me, my servants," the War Master said. Vikishesh offered a glowing, though entirely insincere, smile at Savangla, and stepped forward to bow before him. She straightened and awaited his words, but he offered none until, at his gesture, three Yuuzhan Vong in his command chamber departed. "I have summoned you," the War Master said, "to acknowledge that you do indeed have worth. Your analysis of the situation with my arm was correct. I was afflicted with treachery. I offer you my congratulations." Vicky actually felt her knees go weak. It wasn't from relief at being proven right. No, the story she'd concocted was supposed to be one that would buy her a considerable amount of time to find a way to escape. But she'd been right. The conspiracy had been rooted out, and her time was at an end. Blast the conspirators! Blast them for existing, for being clumsy enough to be detected so early, for fouling up her plan. She didn't let her smile waver. "The fact that I am of some service brings joy to my heart," she said. "I hope that I shall continue to be of worth to you." "You shall. And for your next assignment, you will travel to Coruscant, below us. Yuuzhan Vong warriors have died there, and the burns that killed them suggest strongly that Jidai are the culprits. You will go with Denua Ku and join a search unit there, a unit of warriors, and even our remaining Voxen. They may be dying off, but they can still hunt Jidai. You will offer your insights to the warriors who will run the Jidai to ground. You will have the opportunity to distinguish yourself further in my service." Words nearly failed her. On an expedition into the ruined world's depths, she'd be watched at least as closely as she had been observed here. She'd be forced to travel with a fast-moving pack of idiot warriors, running her into exhaustion. Dirt and sweat would be her companions, and Voxen. The thought of being within kilometers of the ferocious creatures was terrifying. She offered the War Master her most alluring smile and bowed again. The gesture gave her time to find her voice. "I live to obey, War Master." Vanix Vancalay System. "Will you be offering your political support to Senator Gaydon?" The old woman was stiff-backed, as alert as a hawk bat on the lookout for prey, and the downiness of her white hair, which should have softened her appearance, should have made her grandmotherly, instead gave her the aspect of some mad force wizard from a scary bedtime story, to the jagged scar zigzagging across her forehead, which hinted at a fractured skull or even brain damage in some long-ago battle, was hardly reassuring. "Adith enjoys my every confidence," Leia said, her voice smooth. Han waited, though, because he could detect the unspoken "but" at the end of her statement. Admiral Apelban Whirl offered up a faint, exasperated sigh and leaned back in her chair. Her expression suggested that, though this meeting was not over, no further part of it had any purpose. "Personally," Leia concluded. The Admiral gave her a closer look.
"And professionally? Politically?"
"Professionally, I favor the harshest possible resistance to the Yuuzhan Vong."
"Really?"
The Admiral suddenly did not look as forbidding.
"I have no talent for deception, so I'll ask straight out. What would it take to persuade you to lend me your support in this campaign, to help swing the population's vote toward defense and away from appeasement?"
That was, in fact, exactly what Han and Leia had come to offer, a present of public support from the famous Solos. Leia opened her mouth to make that statement, but Han cut her off. "That's what I'd like to ask you. What would it take? What do you have?" The Admiral smiled. It was the expression of an experienced Bantha trader.
"Are you looking for weapons? Vehicles? I suspect that Borlias is already far better supplied than I am."
"We're looking for surprises," Han said. The Vong are going to hit us like an asteroid bombardment. Ultimately, they're going to take Borlias and then begin swarming out in all directions again. What can you give us to make their conquest of Borlias worse for them? What can you give us that they won't expect? Leia kept her mouth shut. She gave Han a sidelong look. He expected it to be an angry one, but he was wrong. She was curious, evaluating.
How are the Yuuzhan Vong fixed for naval warfare?
The Admiral asked. Han frowned. Space Navy?
Water Navy.
I know they have some aquatic creatures, transports, and creatures that allow someone to breathe underwater, but we haven't been faced with any significant water-based assaults.
Meaning they might not have any, or they might still have them in reserve.
The Admiral leaned back. She rested her elbows on the arms of her padded chair, placing her fingertips together before her, as if to suggest a sharply sloped roof.
I've spent the better part of my military career upgrading our armed forces to deal with external threats rather than internal ones, meaning that I have access to a large number of water navy vessels, surface and submersible, most of them currently decommissioned and crewed by droids. They're antiques, but an antique exploding shell can still kill an enemy if it's placed correctly. I could give you several submersibles, large ones for oceans and small ones for rivers, if you can bring me a transport to carry them. And then you'd have weapons, however unlikely, that the Yuuzhan Vong have not encountered on Borlias.
Are they fully armed and operational? Leia asked.
Fully armed and operational.
How many?
I can give you two of the larger submersibles, about the size of Karak cruisers, and four smaller units suited to river traffic.
Make it four and four, and you have a deal, Han said. The Admiral's Bantha trader grin widened.
What deal? You haven't offered anything specific.
We're offering a guarantee, Leia said. We guarantee that you win the election. You'll see the vote turn your way, and you'll be able to see our hand in the turnaround.
Done, the Admiral said. The day after I'm installed in the office of the presider, you receive your eight submersibles.
She extended her hand, and Leia and Han took it in turn. Once they were out of the Admiral's office and off the military base she used as her headquarters, Leia asked,
All right, so you got us something for our help when we are expecting nothing. What precisely do we do with eight submersibles we don't need, which won't do us any good against the Yuuzhan Vong?
Han gave her his crookedest, this time I've got you, my dear, smile.
Plenty.
Let's hear it. First, when we get the transport for the submersibles here, without informing Admiral Ernest back there, we leave one of the big submersibles and one of the small ones behind in the nearest large body of water.
For what purpose?
You've been thinking of the resistance cells as being set up in the major cities, with vehicles and ordnance stored in caves, forgotten underground tanks, whatever the operatives can find. But those submersibles, however antiquated, can serve as preliminary resistance bases and can be used to find caves that can only be reached from underwater. They're not weapons to use on the Yuuzhan Vong, Leia. They're mobile homes that fire explosive shells, enough for four whole resistance cells.
She smiled and considered the idea.
So how do we do it?
Do what?
Rig the election.
I have no idea. I was following your lead, remember? I've never rigged an election.
Han sighed.
Well, you'd better figure it out fast, or I'll have to take your temporary scoundrel's license away.
Borlias. Jag sat propped up against the side of his clawcraft, engrossed in his data pad. The special operations docking bay was, for once, comparatively quiet, only a few clankings and swear words floating in from the far corner to indicate mechanics' activities. He was not too engrossed, though, to see the pair of booted feet appear before him. He looked up and up into the blue features of Shankir Naruodu, a Chiss officer. She'd been his wingmate on his first trip into New Republic space at the start of the Yuuzhan Vong crisis, his sole partner during his recent return, and his second-in-command when he'd founded Vanguard Squadron on Hapes. Now, while he flew with Twin Sun Squadron, she led the Vanguards.
"Colonel, may I sit?"
"Of course." She lowered herself and sat cross-legged opposite him. "I heard that Vanguard Squadron had been classified as fit for elite and special operations," Jag said. "That you were going to be stationed groundside with the rest of us. Congratulations."
"It's just a matter of training, motivating, enforcing discipline," Shankar shrugged. "I came to you because it would be inappropriate for me to reject their promotion, however well-intended, without first talking to you, since you founded the squadron."
"Why would you refuse it?"
"Because I don't intend to lead the squadron much longer, nor should you return to it. It's time for us to leave."
"Explain that."
"Our plan was specific, Colonel. We came back to evaluate the threat the Yuuzhan Vong posed to Chiss Society. We've had time to make that evaluation. Now we should report back with our findings."
Jag regarded her levelly. He'd anticipated this confrontation for some time.
"And what would your report tell our high command?"
"That the Yuuzhan Vong are a significant threat to us, to the Empire, to any societal structure that does not resemble theirs. That the New Republic is shattering on all fronts, and that it is only a matter of time before the Yuuzhan Vong mop up here and spread out to reach us."
"I agree with your conclusions."
"Then let's go."
He shook his head. "I've come to additional conclusions that suggest we should stay."
"May I hear them?"
"I believe that this engagement here on Borlias would be the surest test of Yuuzhan Vong determination and character. Only in seeing how this campaign plays out can we provide a definitive analysis of the enemy that our people will someday face. So it is your plan to return to Chiss space immediately upon the fall of Borlias?"
"No."
"Then I have failed to understand you."
"I didn't describe all my conclusions. A second one, not related to the first, is that my presence here may affect coming events in a small but perhaps measurable way, and that to abandon this campaign now would not only do it harm, but eventually do harm to our people as well. Any damage I do to the enemy here is damage the enemy cannot do to us when they reach us."
"So you will not leave at all?"
"I will leave, eventually."
Shankir considered his words silently. The distant swearing increased in volume to match a sudden spate of hammering that sounded like revenge rather than repair, before fading to its normal levels.
"May I speak freely, pilot to pilot?"
"Of course." "I think that sentiment is clouding your judgment. I think that the notion of not being here when Gina Solo is endangered or killed is what is keeping you from your duty. But your duty is to our people and to no one else."
"Is that true?"
"Yes, you have sworn an oath of loyalty and obedience."
"What if the best observation of loyalty leads on a course that diverges from obedience?"
"It can't."
"I think you're wrong. I am not loyal to the Chiss because my parents were accepted by them, or because I have grown up among them. I'm loyal because they embody traits I admire and respect. They make those traits part of the very fiber of our society, traits such as strength in the face of aggression, such as acknowledgement of duty before self-interest. The Chiss, however, are not the only people with admirable traits, not the only ones who deserve to survive the Yuuzhan Vong, and not the only ones I identify with, not anymore."
"So you think you are supporting a greater good by staying?"
"Yes. We can assemble a report and transmit it by Holocom. We can explain that more evaluation is needed, which is the truth."
"As you see it."
"Yes."
Shankar's expression changed. It did not harden against him,
which was one possibility Jag had acknowledged but did not welcome. Instead, a subtle sadness suffused it. He doubted anyone not well acquainted with her would have detected it. "I will stay," she said, "until Borlias falls. Then I will return home." "Thank you. But if I die here, I want you to promise to return in my place. If I stay here, I am delaying the execution of my duty. If I die, you must carry out my duty." Jag thought about it, and to his way of thinking, she had presented him with an impenetrable argument. His only choices, really, were to agree or to bid her farewell now. And the defenders of Borlias would be that much worse off without her leadership and piloting skills. "I agree," he said. Tark shook Woolam Sayre's hand and said, "I thought you'd be tall." Woolam, graying and distinguished, elder statesman of Coruscant Hall of Journalism, exchanged an amused look with Tam before returning his attention to the child. "I am indeed taller than you." "Yes, but I thought you'd be 2 meters at least."
"An illusion, child. When you are in front of the holocam, you dominate the image. Everything else is secondary to you, so it becomes easy for watchers to believe you are of extravagant proportions."
"Oh," Tark nodded sagely, as though Woolam's words made perfect sense to him. They stood in the lobby of the biotics building, meters from the door out onto the kill zone. The lobby was now set up with desks and stations for junior officers and enlisted personnel. Some directed traffic through the building, others ensured physical and remote security, and still others were located here rather than in locations more appropriate to their specific tasks, because there was no room in those locations for them. But there was still a little open space away from the main flow of traffic, and that's where they stood. 3 generations of homeless civilian males, surrounded by military operations. "So, what's it to be today?" Tam fished around in his expansive bag. He extracted a holocam, a model small enough to be easily concealed in his large hands, with a strap to fit around the back of one hand. This unit he handed to Tark. He showed the boy how to tighten the strap, where to peer into the holocam in order to see what the holocam's lens saw. "How the defenders live," Woolam said. "Bedchambers, meals, medicine, refreshers, exhaustion, stolen moments, spot interviews as I decide. No setups, no analysis." "Why record anything?" Tark asked. "With Coruscant conquered, aren't you out of a job?"
"Never," Woolam said. "I am a historian. Unless nothing sapient survives in all the universe, I have a job, a calling. Someday people will be curious about what happened here, and what we do, recording and analyzing, may be the only surviving answers to their questions."
"In other words," Tam said, "once you know what you are, nobody can ever take your job from you. They can change your circumstances, they can make it hard or impossible for you to get paid." He shot Woolam a sly look, and Woolam gratified him by giving him an indignant little scowl. "But your job is part of you." Tark fell silent, considering that. Tam pulled out his main-duty holocam, a recently manufactured Crystal Memories Model 17, lighter and possessing more standard memory than previous models. He passed its strap over his head. The strap grazed against the fresh scar behind his right ear, the surgical scar over his new implant, the implant that was now his only defense against the deadly headaches brought on by his conditioning. Changed circumstances, indeed.
"What should I record?" Tark asked.
"Everything?"
"At first, if you want to," Tam said. "What I do is to record everything Woolam points at until he gives me the kill sign."
Obligingly, Woolam made a gesture like an abbreviated axe chop. His pale hands against his black garments made the gesture especially easy to see.
"And also anything I find interesting or unusual. You do the same,
and when we review your recordings together, I'll point out what looks interesting from a historical record perspective.
Don't spend too much of your time on the girls, Woolham cautioned. Tark's face twisted into an expression of disdain.
You don't have to worry about that.
Coruscant. I hate this, Luke said.
Waiting? Mara, eyes closed, adjusted her pose, trying to make herself comfortable. As comfortable as one could be, propped up against a deformed metal wall in a hallway dripping with rainwater that had filtered through 30 or 40 stories of ruined skyscraper above, on a planet ruled and increasingly ruined by alien enemies.
Of course, waiting.
Luke had returned half an hour before from the latest scattering run. Not everyone was back. A few meters down the hallway, Danny was cataloging plant samples, and Baljos and Elisar were playing sabac underneath a flickering glow light. The others were still unaccounted for.
Which points to a great failing with the Jedi, the lightsabers.
Luke gave his wife a suspicious look.
A failing?
She nodded.
You can't sharpen them.
Back when I was, well, in my previous career, I could get through any boring stretch by sharpening my knives. It takes just enough of your attention to keep boredom at bay, and keeps your tools at their best. With vibroblades, even if they lose power, you still have a nice sharp edge for whatever needs cutting.
Elisar looked back over his shoulder at her. Sometimes I think you can be spooky just singing nursery songs.
That's easy. Mara's face took on an expression of motherly concern.
Hush, child, she sang. The night is mild, and slumber smiles upon you.
But she sang the familiar tune in a minor key, making the words unsettling rather than soothing, evoking the mental image of an anthropomorphic slumber that was a night monster stealing silently up to a crib. But she fell silent, and Luke could feel from her what he felt in himself, a wish, one that could not be fulfilled now, that they could be where Ben was, introducing him to all the little surprises and delights that came with just being alive. Instead, they were here, in this endless expanse of death. Then Mara opened her eyes and looked back down the hall. Luke felt it too, not danger, but some agitation expressed through the Force. He rose and put his hand on his lightsaber hilt. Up through a hole in the floor swung Tahiri. She landed and extended a hand down, helping Face up to this level. She was somber. He looked dubious. When she saw Luke, she gulped. Not out of uncertainty or fear, Luke thought, but out of nausea.
I've found something, she said.